The Blonde Tiger by Leslie Boylan. Copyright 2024 by Palmetto Publishing. It may or may not be true, but it definitely happened. Edward Rotkoff. Dedication to my parents, Natty and Eddie, and to relatives I never met or was too young to remember. Chapter 1, 1930. The delivery was bloodier and more painful than Gussie had expected. Goldie, the midwife a neighbor had recommended, pulled the boy out like she was pulling a brisket from the oven. She chatted and fussed as if Gussie were listening. Gussie turned her face away when Goldie started cleaning the newborn, enough to place him in her arms. Gussie didn't want him. He was her fourth child, and she was sick of children. As it was with this depression that everyone was talking about, she could barely feed the ones she had. She forced herself to look down at him, small and prune-like, eyes closed against the early sunlight. She knew she should feel lucky about surviving the delivery of another boy. Her sister Sadie had died in childbirth after delivering a healthy boy, and the father, a builder, was raising him on practically nothing. Gussie's mother, Yetta, had hidden her three boys in Poland while the pogroms raged in their shtetl. Gussie was alive and healthy and didn't need to hide her children. Those were the good things she could say about America. There were very few good things she could say about anything. Sam wanted to name the baby Edward after his father. They'd argued, but Sam rarely put his foot down, so she took him seriously. Gussie scolded Goldie for not cleaning everything up right away. She wanted the room neat and clean, despite the birth. Even when she worked as a seamstress in Poland, she made sure to keep her work area tidy. The bedroom was one of three rooms, including a tiny kitchen. The furniture was sparse but well made. Sam, a carpenter, had built or refurbished everything they had. Gussie gently touched the amulet that hung above her head on the hard wooden headboard Sam had carved out of a tree that had fallen in the yard. The scrap of paper in the amulet was covered with Hebrew letters she could not read, but the amulet comforted her, as did the pin she'd placed under the cradle blankets before the birth. She was not happy about having another baby, but she didn't want the angel of death flying away with him. Gussie had thought she was done with babies, and this pregnancy surprised her. Gussie hadn't believed she was pregnant until her clothes began to tighten around her waist. She'd never allowed herself to gain a pound, as strict with her diet as with everything else in her life and everyone else's. She'd left Poland before her mother was old enough to be done having babies, or to explain to her when that might happen. That made Gussie think of the old women in the village. No one knew their exact age, least of all the women themselves, but they couldn't have been more than 45. They wore babushkas, headscarves in public, and had wrinkled faces and sad eyes. Many were permanently stooped and had gnarled hands from too much work. Gussie thought the women in Brooklyn were so different. Even those with little money and a lot of children looked younger and less careworn. Now Gussie lay spent after 12 hours in labor. She relaxed in the beautiful but worn handmade quilt, clean sheets, and plumped pillows. At 40, her light blonde hair lay loose on the pillow. This was one of the few times it was loose. She only ever took the pins out when she prepared for bed. During the day, she wore a crown of two blonde braids wrapped around each other. She could still feel the sweat on her scalp despite the vigorous washing by the midwife. But it was early April and prematurely warm. The window was closed to ward off the evil eye. Despite the unexpectedly long labor, it had not been a difficult delivery. As much as she hated having another child, pregnancy and delivery were things she did well. She considered herself to do most things well. She couldn't read or write in any language, but she knew all she needed to know, and what she didn't know didn't matter. Another thing she knew she was good at was cooking. Even her worst enemy had to admit that. She made all the recipes from the old country, picking the feathers from the chickens she got from the kosher butcher before she boiled the meat in a large pot on the stove. She remembered watching Yetta make meals from whatever she scrounged from the earth in their tiny garden in Poland. That brought up another sour thought. It was not hard to observe the old country ways and follow kosher rules here in Brooklyn. But her children were Americans, casual about tradition, religion, and customs she considered vitally important to maintaining Jewish life. Sam had also become an American. He had completely assimilated into the land of opportunity. She held it against him and never let him forget it. Gussie wished she knew that the time she had labored off and on throughout the night. The sun shone through the closed window curtains, but it could just as easily be dawn as noon. She realized she was hungry, having had no food since before labor began. She decided she didn't care what time it was, as long as there was something ready to eat. Goldie was used to being in charge during home births, but not this time. As soon as the labor pains began, Gussie had made it clear she'd had three children without any problems. She knew what to do and had bossed and ordered Goldie throughout the labor, barely stopping to catch her breath between spasms of pain. "There's no telling this woman anything," thought Goldie. Gussie's reputation for nastiness was well known in the neighborhood. Goldie knew the type, strong-willed and difficult. Goldie usually loved working with pregnant women. She'd learned midwifery from her mother, who delivered countless newborns in damp barns and on dirt floors in Poland, but gave birth to Goldie by herself in Brooklyn. Most of Goldie's clients were also poor women, but now and then her name found its way to a society matron who wanted to deliver at home on silken sheets with an experienced, undaunted attendant. Most women, no matter how strong-willed, let the midwife take charge once they began labor. Even the rich ones, who were used to telling everyone what to do, gave themselves up to Goldie's ministrations. Gussie was another matter altogether. She refused to listen and directed the labor and delivery the same way she ruled her family, like a czar. Goldie knew her appearance helped with most clients. She was a harmless-looking woman, middle-aged, with scraggly, graying hair piled on top of her head, a substantial bosom, and strong hands. When she visited her clients, she dressed in a way that would make them comfortable. With society matrons, she wore a dark navy blue uniform she had created herself. With Gussie, she wore a clean, faded house dress and thick-soled shoes. She charged the rich women three times more than the poor ones and used the money to buy little things for her poor ladies, things they couldn't afford for their babies, like extra cloth diapers or bottles or food for their other children. Goldie smiled inwardly and finished cleaning up. She'd washed Gussie, removed the soiled bedding and towels, and baby Edward was settled quietly in the cradle. An aura of tranquility had settled over the room. It was the time both women secretly liked best. Just after a birth, when everything was clean, the baby was quiet, and the chaos of the household was held at bay on the other side of the door. The few moments of tranquility didn't last long. The newborn was crying. Goldie stopped gathering her things as she prepared to leave and went to tend to him. He had soft yellow curls and a newborn's blue eyes. He seemed healthy and robust to her experienced eyes and hands. She was pleased that Gussie observed the old world traditions as she shifted the pin to ensure that it wouldn't prick the baby. She believed strongly in these traditions and encouraged all her laboring mothers to observe them, except for those who lived uptown and scorned the old ways. Goldie picked Edward up and tightened the blanket around him, then passed him to Gussie to nurse. At first, he had some trouble understanding what he was supposed to do, but soon caught on. Gussie peered down at him in disgust. Another mouth to feed, another little animal wanting things. she thought. "See what's in the kitchen," she said to Goldie. "I'm hungry, too." Goldie left the room. Miriam, 11, and Edna, 5, tiptoed in with some bread and a glass of hot tea. Miriam closed the door quickly so her father and brother wouldn't see their mother's naked breast. Gussie motioned to them to come alongside the bed. She switched the baby to the other breast and ate the bread with her free hand. When he was finished, she gave Edward to Miriam to place back in the cradle while she drank her tea. Edna handed her mother the worn cotton bed jacket so she could cover herself. Gussie looked at her daughters and decided that once he was weaned off the breast, they could mother him, allowing her to pretend her progeny stopped at 3. She found her daughters barely tolerable, but she could rely on them. They'd already taken on a lot of the housework and some cooking. Before this pregnancy, Gussie had reached a point in her life when she could begin to dream about a future after the children were grown. With everyone gone during the day, Sam and Mac at work, and Miriam and Edna at school, she'd managed to carve out a little quiet time for herself after the cleaning and shopping were done, and before the laundry and cooking began. She mourned the loss of that little piece of quiet time, knowing with Edward's birth it was gone for many years to come. She blamed him for delaying the rest she felt she'd earned. Goldie returned to the room and said, "I'm ready to go now, Gittela," using an affectionate form of Gussie's name. She didn't like the way Gussie had treated her, but she made a rule of wiping the slate clean after delivery for all her mothers. She knew even the most devoted mother rarely looked forward to yet another pregnancy, especially when money was scarce. "You're lucky to have such helpers. What pretty girls! Is there anything else I can do for you? I'll be back tomorrow to see how you are," she said in Yiddish, aware that Gussie knew very little English. Goldie smoothed the quilt over her patient. "Why don't you get some sleep?" "Eh, I'll sleep if I want to sleep. My husband will pay you," replied Gussie gruffly in Yiddish. "Danke," said Goldie softly. She put the dirty linens and cloths in a large flour sack in the kitchen and took it with her to launder. That was always part of her service. With a wink and a smile for the girls, Goldie left the room to collect her pay from Sam. Miriam knew her mother expected her to see to everything now that the midwife had gone. She checked the baby, who was tightly swaddled and sleeping soundly again. She decided to call him Eddie. She gently touched his cheek, silently vowing to protect him from their mother. Edna followed Miriam about, mimicking her every move. Sam walked in after paying Goldie and seeing her on her way. He stood in the doorway to gaze upon his new son. Then he tiptoed to the cradle to touch the boy. "No, no, you must wait," Gussie said, waving him away. "You'll wake him. Don't touch him," she commanded in Yiddish. Sam winked at his daughters, smiling despite his disappointment. He knew his wife. There was no sense arguing with her. He went to the bed to kiss Gussie, who turned her head so he barely bust her cheek. Then he and the girls went back to the kitchen to drink coffee with Mac and toast the birth. Sam drummed his fingers on the wooden table that he'd made shortly after getting married. He tapped his feet on the floor, anxious and impatient, but in good humor, happy the baby was healthy and that all had gone well. "Edna," Gussie called through the open doorway from the bedroom to the kitchen, "give me my brush and pins." "Look, Mama, now we both have babies," said Edna in English, rushing to her mother, doll in hand. "Can I brush your hair, Mama?" Gussie nodded, tilting her head back and closing her eyes as Edna brushed out the silky hair that reached to Gussie's waist. Gussie enjoyed another moment of peace, then grabbed the hairbrush from her startled daughter and started to braid the damp hair. Gussie's hands moved swiftly, intertwining her hair from muscle memory. There was no mirror in the room. Edna held out the pins as Gussie coiled the braids around her head, jabbing the pins into her own scalp as punishment for having another baby. When the baby began to fuss, Gussie signaled that Sam could now touch his child. Since finishing his coffee, he had been pacing with hands in his pockets, mumbling Hebrew prayers for the health and happiness of his new son. He didn't mind Gussie's obsession with the old world rituals, but he didn't believe in them. He'd left all that behind in Russia. He'd moved to the threshold of the bedroom, noting the amulet tied to the headboard, before striding over to the cradle he'd made 15 years ago for their first child, Mac. He could remember pulling the cradle out of storage and carefully resanding its wood to ensure nothing would hurt the new child. That was his way of protecting the newborn, better than amulets or pins. "I think we should call him Eddie, Pop," said Miriam in English, standing behind her father as Sam reached down to pick up his wriggling son. He cradled him with the gentleness and assurance of an experienced father, talking to him in English, then Yiddish, then Russian, each word a nothing that people the world over murmur to babies. "Yes, Eddie's a good name. What a handful he is, a good, strong boychik." Loud grunting came from Gussie, who turned her face away into her pillow to avoid the happy scene. "Take him in the other room and let me get some rest." Eddie was always hungry and loved the comfort from the blanket swaddling him and the warm arms of people who adored him. Miriam realized he seemed to sense Gussie's disdain. He fed eagerly from her breasts, but once satiated, he didn't want to remain in her arms any more than Gussie wanted him there. When Miriam, Mac, or Sam held him, he was content until it was time to eat again. On the eighth day, the bris, a ritual circumcision, was held in the tiny living room. Mac found a moil to perform the ritual. Miriam and Mac informed family and close friends and invited members of the synagogue on the corner to attend. Although the synagogue was right on the corner, Sam didn't attend it or any other. Gussie constantly scolded him for this, saying, "It's a shanda, a disgrace." Sam told his children that he believed in the Almighty, but had no interest in attending services. Gussie remained in her bed. She was not expected to attend the ceremony or look after the guests. Miriam and Aunt Fanny prepared the food and greeted everyone. Sam told them to spend lavishly for the occasion. Against Gussie's wishes, he told them to make treats that the guests would not soon forget. He rarely defied her, but this day was special. The other women, dressed in their best clothes, stood in the background as the black-suited men recited poems and sang Yiddish songs. Everyone laughed at the familiar tunes. "I know a good thing. It's good for everyone. Chicken! Go to a celebration, a bris, don't eat meat or fish, just chicken. You'll never complain, it won't knot up your stomach, it won't give you heartburn. Dear people, obey my plan, you'll be happy and healthy. Eat chicken." Eddie was given a little kosher wine before the circumcision. Afterward, he was brought into his mother to nurse. Sam regaled the guests with stories of Max's bris and childhood years. The relatives had heard the stories before, but Sam had a way of retelling them that made them funnier and more entertaining every time. It was a joyous occasion. "So then, Mac took my old cigar box with the tooth powder and one pair of his underwear and set off down the block. He kept looking back at me to check if I was watching him. He didn't watch where he was going, so he fell flat on his face." Mac, standing next to his father among the male guests, laughed. "I remember that, Pop. My nose bled for an hour. You didn't say anything about me running away. You just carried me home and put some ice on it. Then we had ice cream at the candy store." Sam laughed, too. "You were so serious, I had to keep from laughing at your stern little face. It was a good thing your mother wasn't home. But later?" "She rarely let you have it later, Pop. Like it was your fault." "I don't think she's forgiven me yet," laughed Sam, short and stocky with a square face and an ever-present cigar hanging from his lower lip. After everyone had gone, Sam went to the bedroom to check on his wife and newborn son. Miriam, Fanny, and Edna were cleaning up. "I heard you talking about me. Do you think I can't hear everything in this tiny apartment? Making fun of your own son? I was right to be angry, and yes, I still am," said Gussie quietly, afraid of waking Eddie. "It was just a joke, Gittela," said Sam as he removed his suit jacket and replaced his one pair of good shoes with slippers. Before she could reply, he went into the kitchen to grab whatever food was left. He hadn't had time to eat during the celebration. Sam tolerated Gussie's henpecking without comment and frequently managed to coax a small smile from his diminutive wife when he shared a new Yiddish joke he'd heard. Gussie made sure the family was fed and clothed and set high expectations for the children, but she rarely showed them any affection. Sam was the hugger, had a wonderful sense of humor, and made sure to find time to listen to his children. "Mac went out to get us some bread. We're all out," said Miriam, who changed out of her good dress into one of her mother's old shmatas, an old house dress. She was drying the dishes as Fanny washed them. Edna was putting away the silverware and tidying up the living room. "Here's some leftover lox, Pop," said Miriam, handing it to her father on one of the clean plates. "And Fanny made it." "It's delicious, Fan. Thanks for being here and for all your help," said Sam, giving her a quick hug. "I'll take over the dishes. You go on home now. We'll see you tomorrow." Fanny grabbed her dark blue cloth coat and matching handbag from the hook by the door. She was anxious to go home. Her feet hurt from standing all day. She threw kisses at the girls and left quietly. Sam told his children to go rest. As he washed the dishes, he thought about how lucky his family was. His father, a shipbuilder, had taught him carpentry, then insisted he leave Russia and live with relatives in Scotland. "Get yourself to America," his father had said after Sam's brother was killed in a pogrom. "Don't come back." His father gave him a few coins he'd saved and accompanied him to the dock. Sam remembered his mother, Miriam, crying and tearing her clothes as if in mourning. She and other mothers in the shtetl had to let go of their children to save them. It had been a shocking change for a 15-year-old, but his father wanted him out of Russia after the Tsar overturned the revolution of 1905. Sam had gone to Scotland first, since there was family there with whom he could stay. When they sailed to America to go into vaudeville, he'd moved to Blackpool, England, and worked on the dock saving money for his own passage across the Atlantic. He hadn't found the work hard since he was used to physical labor and liked working with his hands. Sam laughed to himself when he remembered having to learn English in three very different dialects. His children teased him about his Yiddish, Russian, Scottish, British, American accent. He'd met Gussie shortly after arriving in New York. Her brother-in-law, Fanny's husband, had hired him to work in his construction business. Sam liked living in the Brooklyn apartment building with Gussie and the kids. His Jewish, Irish, and Italian neighbors were friendly. Everyone helped each other, especially now when so many of the families were using their savings to get through the week.